two guests in the studio for Synext Radio tonight. None of us are your regular host, Marilyn James. My name is Catherine Fisher. I also have Kaylinda Keevy here and Eileen Delahanty Perks. And both Kaylinda and Eileen are local authors and have written fairly extensively about the Synext and also about the local botany of the area, and that is what they're going to be talking about this evening. Am I right?
Right. So at this time of year, one of the things that I really groove on, speaking of groove, is all of the plant life reemerging, unfolding, coming back into being. And it's just so very exciting. And for me, a lot of my connection to the Synext is also through the plant life, because, of course, they have a very big connection historically and traditionally to all of the plants that grow here. Many of them were food plants or medicinal plants. I mean, they were the brothers and sisters, so to speak.
Definitely. On a not so perfectly ideal note, though, I will say that Parish Coupe Lloyd, which is the Bible for those plant lovers out there, it's a wonderful resource, the Plants of the Southern Interior by Parish Coupe and Lloyd. This book makes no mention of the Synext and their use of the plant materials. Mm-hmm. It was edited in part by Nancy Turner, who's an esteemed ethnobotanist in the province of British Columbia, and Nancy has actually done a disservice to the Synext by continually ignoring or glossing over their presence in the landscape, in large part because the Synext are technically extinct and are unable to participate in land claims affairs. And Nancy has worked for and is friends with the Tanaha Nation, and as a result of that close contact with them, she has felt awkward about bringing the Synext presence forward. So when people go to this important resource for understanding their local plants, it's a great source of sadness to me that they're going to open that up. They're going to say, oh, I want to know more about Oregon grape. And they're going to see that the Okanagan peoples used it for this or that, but they're not going to see any mention of the Synext, which is most unfortunate and handicaps all of us, really, from developing that close relationship. So your connection to the Synext through the plants is very admirable, but it has not been facilitated by the research tools that are out there for those of us who are naturalists, which is quite unfortunate.
Well, it's a general Victoria thing, actually. My friend Martin just gave me a map of First Nations of BC, and the Synext aren't on there, of course. It's everything that comes out of Victoria. You go into the museums on the coast, and there's this big blank where the Synext once thrived and continue to exist. And it's very shocking to me, because clearly, you know, in the circles I move in here, everyone acknowledges the Synext. Everyone knows who Marilyn James is. Everyone gets it. Yeah. And so it's not just an obliteration of their reality. It's also an obliteration of our reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as I have said before, the extinction of the Synext, which was a bureaucratic move, which the government has readily acknowledged, did not create an extinction as a tribal group, that they may have ceased to exist as a band under the Indian Act, but they're not extinct as a tribal group. And the government acknowledges that, and yet that extinction has created a form of extinction of history. They're just ignored by a lot of the standard ways of looking at landscape and history, which I agree with you, Kaylinda, it's befuddling to me. But the connection is there to be made, and this time of year is a very fine time to be making that connection. Although we're even a little late. I mean, the women would have already been full scale into gathering mode by now. They would have already gathered the chocolate tip lilies bulbs. They would have already gathered the avalanche or the glacier lily bulbs. They would have already gathered the false Solomon seal that we recognize now with its little foam of white flowers at the end of the stem. That Solomon seal.
I certainly did my piece this year with the Solomon
seal.
Did you?
I do every year.
Oh, I love them.
For those listeners out there, the time to harvest the false Solomon seal and the balsam root sunflower, for those who are lucky enough to live in a place that's arid and warm enough to have balsam root sunflower on your property, that is the earliest shoots that were harvested just as they were coming above the surface of the soil. The very earliest greens, really, I think, were the Solomon seal and the balsam root sunflower. So for us to imagine a winter without fresh greens, I mean, we're so spoiled, but mm-hmm. the Sinaiks living here would have not touched a fresh green for months on end. Yeah. And those first shoots of the false Solomon seal, man, they must have had some kind of party when yeah. they saw them coming up.
Well, one of the things I'd encourage people to do if they want to collect false Solomon seal is to spot a patch, like get to know the plant now and figure out where it grows and then go back to that spot in spring. Because when it's coming up out of the ground, if you don't know the yeah. plant, you're not exactly yeah. sure that that's yeah. what's what. And take a close look at the stem, because I know that on our property, the Hooker's Fairy Bell grows in the same places, and it's not edible. And the stem is different. It's slightly more speckled, a bit darker colored.
Good.
But take a look at them at this time of year when it's easy to tell, oh, yeah, this is definitely a false Solomon seal. You know, it's totally recognizable yeah. from the form and the flower. Yeah. And then so that next year you'll be geared up to go, okay, I feel confident enough. And it tastes like asparagus. If you chomp yeah. into something, it doesn't taste like asparagus. You got the wrong plant.
Spit it back out.
Yeah.
I'd also say, though, that something that Marilyn James has made really clear to mm-hmm. me that is quite fascinating when you think about it is that we tend to take a harvest mentality mm-hmm. toward food gathering that echoes the agricultural background that most of us come from. Mm-hmm. So we're used to growing plant foods in a plot, and then when they're all ripe, we harvest everything. We take it all and we either store it or we feast on it or we preserve it. Mm-hmm. But with the Sinaiks, they definitely maximize their use of the resources, but they did not have a take it all attitude about mm-hmm. plant foods
yeah.
because they understood, as with the salmon, that to take too much at any one time would actually challenge that plant's ability to produce the following year or the year after that. So it's
yeah.
very important for those of us who are gathering wild plant foods to take only a little bit.
Yeah, my guideline is less than 1 in 10.
Oh, that's sort of very conservative. They probably would have been higher than that, but
Good. But there's more of us.
Yes, you're
so
right.
So you know, lacking information, I've been watching the patch where I harvest and just getting a sense of am I having an impact, because I've been picking there for 10 years now and looks like it's still thriving. But I am concerned, because I do know that the deer also go through there and chomp off the tops of them.
Mm.
So sometimes they're taking their tenth. Uh-huh. Before I come and take my tenth, and I don't know who else is taking another tenth. So I think that's a good practice.
I want to hear you read something from The Inner Green, but before you do, mm-hmm. I just want to read one paragraph from The Geography of Memory, because I think it really relates exactly to what we're talking about, which is the harvesting. In The Geography of Memory, I talk in particular about the myth of the frogs, the Frog Mountain story, about how the frogs came to the people when they were in a place of starvation and need and offered themselves as food. And I tell a background of that story, and then I hone in the text here on one of the most important aspects of the Frog Mountain story, which is not necessarily the frogs or the survival of the people, but the fact that the frogs offered themselves as food. So let me just read this paragraph. It is a subtle yet important distinction that in the story of the Frog Mountain, the frogs offered themselves to be eaten. This spirit of an animal or a plant offering itself permeates the approach of any nature-related people to their food. Their relationship with landscape was reciprocal and receptive. I think about how the summer return of the salmon to the region's rivers must have been viewed by those who had waited all year for the fresh, flushed fish to swim home, or the first shoots of the chocolate tips peeking up through the slushy March snow, fresh greens after months of only dried food. Or the avalanche lily in flower again on a mossy outcropping, a signal that it was time to collect the fist-sized roots beneath the soil. Or the arrival of deer to lower elevations in times of heavy snowfall, when fresh meat would be welcomed. The recurrent cycles of nature in these valleys would have had a deep, appreciative quality about them, not only for the beauty of the seasons, but also for the nourishment and life energy being offered by the earth.
Right. Which reminds me of the whole reciprocal thing. One of the things that Marilyn and others have advised that people do when they collect plants is to leave an offering. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a recognition of there's a gift made, and often we reciprocate with a gift. Mm-hmm. So that
can
be
anything.
Well,
on top of that, it's gratitude too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a concrete representation of gratitude.
Yeah. And that's something really, really important that I think we as a culture could could definitely work on, and that is just being grateful for the fact that these plants return to us. And as an agricultural descended people, we're more interested in this active engagement. We make it happen. We plant the garden, we cultivate, we make it happen. But for the Aboriginal people, it was the creator and the natural energies of the earth that made it happen, right? It just sprang forward to them as a gift, and their gratefulness for the gift was perhaps a little easier to see their way to than it is for us, because we're so interested in managing and controlling how things happen. And I'm a gardener too. I'm all over it. I mean, I've got my little plot of potatoes planted. I love every second of my garden. But there's something in the wild plants that's different, isn't there? I mean, do you feel different about eating those wild plants?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I mean, it's something, it's a precious luxury. I brought home some fiddleheads the other day. And, you know, I was cooking supper with a friend, and she sort of didn't know what to do with them, so she sort of ignored them. And I had this sense of deep insult to the earth that the gift of this wild food that I had harvested was overlooked in favor of broccoli or some such thing sent in from your home state.
I doubt she meant it as an insult.
No, she didn't. Absolutely, it was. No. It was just. But it was interesting to feel that in me. Like this is a treasure. Like it's for me, that wild food is a real treasure, because it has levels of nutrients and complexity of flavor that nothing that we grow in gardens does.
Well, and I think it's really interesting too in my work, bless you, Catherine, in my work as a researcher and writer for the Nelson Museum exhibit, there was Richard Fry is a very well-known first white man settler person in the region. And there had been an awful lot of historical attention through the years placed on this first white man. And as I dug a little deeper into the story, I, of course, realized something I'd already known but became very clear to me, that Richard Fry's wife was Justine Sousteel Fry, the daughter of a chief who was born and raised near the mouth of the Pend'Oreille River down near the U.S.-Canada border. Justine ended up marrying Richard in that time period around the fur trade transforming into the gold rush period. And something that was very little understood by anyone was that Richard Fry's brave conquest as the first white man to live in Nelson, the first white man to survive in this area, was, I'm sure, a large bit to do with the fact that he had a Sinaixt woman in his company who knew the wild plant foods, who could help him survive beyond beans and, you know, rice or flour, and they could have variety in their diet. And she had, I'm sure, a great knowledge of the medicinal plants as well, so that if either one of them was feeling unwell, she could help him feel better. But it's fascinating to me that that piece of the story had just been buried by time very easily, because it sort of wrecks the romance of it if he survived because of her and her knowledge of these wild plants that were everywhere.
The same thing with David Thompson and Charlotte Small.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, there's another adventurer who's got a big name and had a Métis or First Nations woman.
Well, she was Cree, actually.
Oh, okay. Cree woman in his company who would have been familiar with the land, although not the specific ecology, but enough, you know, to know how to enter into and interact with and and open to knowledge.
And who would have had the patience and the wherewithal, you know, the endurance. I mean, these native people, to wait patiently for the return of the wild plant foods, the return of the salmon, that took a lot of patience. That took a lot of endurance.
It took endurance.
You couldn't control when they were coming.
Took more endurance than patience. I mean, because it's not like, you know, patience would be if you could drive to the supermarket and get it, but you don't, you wait for them. Like, there was just no option, right? You just got to wait.
And this spring of ours here, the spring of 2008, has been a very late. I thought a lot about the ancestral food gatherers this spring, because the avalanche lilies and the shoots of the false Solomon seal, some of these early plant foods, they were very late to come, even by, you know, the mountain standards. And there was a time there in latter March and into April, where April really was the time of the first foods. And there was no sign of most of them this year. They were really late. And that would have been a lot of hunger among the Sinaixt people in a spring like this.
Yeah. Do you have any idea whether they ate fiddleheads?
I'm not sure. I was going to bring my trusty resource. I'll promote it right now. There's a book called The Ethnobotany of the Okanagan-Colville People, and it was written by Randy Bouchard, Dorothy Kennedy, and Nancy Turner, and there is a library copy. It's in the permanent collection, not allowed to be out circulating. Unfortunately, many copies of it went missing over the years, never returned, so it is not for circulation, but that's my Bible.
Public Library?
It's available at the Nelson Public Library, and it's called The Ethnobotany of the Okanagan Colville. Mm-hmm. Notice the absence of the word Seneixed or Lakes Indians, again, for the same reasons we talked about earlier, that they were classifying these people by language rather than cultural tribal affiliation. Mm-hmm. And Okanagan Colville is a language term which is used to include them. Mm-hmm. A lot of the information in there is invaluable, and I based my chart in the Geography of Memory on that work. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, Kaylinda, if they ate fiddleheads or not. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that they would have, because they would have figured most things out. Mm-hmm. I'm now going to scurry home and look it up.
well, drop me a line and let me know.
I will do that.
Okay, well,
so why
I'm going to
hear
read
from the inner green.
Right. One of the plants that I love that apparently is also edible as a spring green, according to a book I have about wild edible plants written by an Alaskan woman, and I forget what her name is Devil's Club.
Oh, really?
And because it's such a potent...
It doesn't scratch the throat on the way down?
No, the new shoots don't have any of the thorns on them.
Oh, my gosh.
At the tops of the stems, right? These little, and I ate one year, and I just thought, this tastes too powerful to eat as food. It just didn't... I couldn't proceed, even though, you know, I didn't have any ill effects from that, but it just didn't feel right. I have a huge respect for... Devil's Club, and so I'm going to read about that. One of my all-time favorite plants is Devil's Club. I introduce it to everyone who comes to visit me. This is, in part, due to my fondness for it, but more so because one of its distinctive features, thorns. Devil's Club has some of the most fearsome, potent thorns ever invented by nature. Not only are they long, fine, and sharp, but once pricked, they exude a poison into the skin that can create ongoing burning and even a festering wound. Its scientific name was well chosen, Oplopanax horridus. Hikers and forest workers are well versed in its biting characteristic, and it is often called the hiker's curse. Local people learn the easier, hard way how to recognize it. Devil's Club grows in luxuriant, moist places, in swamps, or along stream edges in a tangle of thorny stems and an explosion of leaves. A.O. Wheeler, an early 1900s topographer for the construction of the railways in the region, described it as, quote, a bare stick, an inch thick and 5 to 8 feet high, with a spread of tropical-looking palmated leaves at the top, set off by a bunch of bright red berries. A beauty indeed. What I love so much about this plant is the phenomenal growth, symbol of its extreme success in its ecological niche. The leaves are huge. No dinner plates here, but rather feast patterns of an intense green. The shiny red panicle of berries are glorious decoration for this splendid spread. And the stem is a vision of vigor, spreading as it does above and under the ground. One day, my neighbor Jake handed me a small piece of wood, about a foot long and 3 or 4 centimeters in diameter. Well, that's kind of interesting. I just noticed I mixed feet, metric, and imperial. We did a scouring of imperial in this book to replace it all with metric. Do you remember that? We had to figure out how many cubic meters of water were behind the dams. Anyway, that one escaped me. I guess that would be 30 centimeters long and 3 or 4 centimeters in diameter. What is it? He asked, his eyes twinkling. Aha, a trick. I hefted it in my palm. It felt light. I pulled its smooth surface across my hand. I put it to my nose, and then there was no doubt. Devil's Club, I told him. Delighted, but disappointed that he hadn't been able to trick me, he asked me how I knew. Nothing smells like Devil's Club does. Its strong, vaguely medicinal odor has the pungency of mushrooms, but with the zing of green. As a member of the ginseng family, it carries unique and potent substances within it. I was not surprised to discover the serious medicinal properties of Devil's Club. The First Nations people have long used it to remedy various ailments. It is named in over 25 languages in North America and has had a high cultural importance as well as a medicinal value. Its glucosides and aromatic oils affect the body's hypothalamic pituitary axis, whatever that is. Its use as an herbal control for diabetes has been studied, as well as its healing ability for rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune disorders. The Sinaiks used it to treat consumption or a dry cough. Though it's a formidable plant in many ways, the medicine of the Devil's Club was known to be sensitive to disturbance. An infusion was placed by a creek to keep it cool, and one had to be careful not to allow the shadow of a person to pass over it. Modern herbalists echo the practices of ancient ones, in part, by recommending only a cold infusion of the roots. The uses of Devil's Club do not stop at the medicinal. The Sinaiks apparently use the thorns for pinning and sewing together. Thus, this spectacular plant had a status far beyond that of its current notoriety as the bane of hikers. It was and is a reminder of what is fierce, formidable, and even painful, and is to be honored for the power it inevitably holds. So do not tremble so much in fear as in deep respect when you step among its thorny glory and bow to its strength and beauty as you give it respectful birth. Long live Devil's Club.
That's great. I'm reminded there in that reading of where you talk about the sensitivity of the plant and how it needed to be kept in a certain place in order to not lose its power, that the Sinaiks were very, you know, we use the word superstitious, mm-hmm. I think, but I'm not sure I like that word. They were very sensitive to the needs of plants and the sort of unspoken, non-rational aspects of a plant's power. And even in terms of their own gathering, the women were very sensitive around gathering plant material, working with the plants, not to offend the plants. Women who were in the middle of their menses typically stayed away from plants. If women were angry or upset, they'd had a fight with their spouse or a bad dream or something like that that had unsettled them emotionally, they tended out of respect to the plants to stay away from the gathering work that day. And I think this is something for us that's almost unheard of as a concept, this idea that we will stay away from a plant in that way because it's, you know, we're going to offend the plant. We don't tend to think of plants that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for them, the plant was a very, very much a being of its own, and how we treated it, even with the mood that we took, might affect the supply that the plant was to give.
Mm-hmm.
I know that last year I was at a memorial, a memorial service, actually a sort of a year later memorial for a woman who had passed on, a Sinaiks woman. And a year after the death, they have a massive giveaway of all of her possessions. And everyone who attends the giveaway gets a piece of her possessions. And I was commenting to one of the people who's related to the woman who passed on what a wonderful tradition this was, that they would be giving away pieces of this woman so in this generous way. And she said, well, I want those huckleberries to be as big as my eyeballs when I'm out there gathering this summer.
Hmm.
And I realized when she said that there was a direct correlation in her mind between the release of her grandmother's spirit and the generosity that she and her family showed in giving away the grandmother's possessions, mm-hmm. and the pleasing of the plant community to provide them with huckleberries that were, you know, abundant and juicy and whole. And this is something that I think has almost a cosmic ring to it, that there's a whole conversation going on in the universe that we're actually quite a bit lower down in terms of our ability to understand it, and that the plants are very sensitive, which makes me wonder what it was like to have sudden conquest during the mining and exploration period, whole hillsides burned off. You know, entire places of gathering, entire gathering fields would have been plowed up to plant and, you know, to plant with farm crops. And I think for the plants, as well as for the people, this would have been shocking and, you know, really difficult, which of course makes me sound very New Agey and flaky, but...
Oh, we all know that's true.
I can't help it.
We all know you're a hardcore flake, Eileen.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway,
this is Synext Radio in conversation with Kaylinda Keevy and Eileen Delahanty Perks. I'm going to put those two back on, and they have lots more interesting things to say.
So, Kaylinda, why don't you tell us a little bit more about offerings when you gather plants? The traditional practice of the Synext would have been to make an offering of gratitude. And why don't you talk a little bit about how you have translated that practice of theirs into the 21st century here in the Kootenays?
Right. Well, at some point, I you know, in my wildcrafting practice, I went and asked Marilyn. I said, you know, is there something that I need to be doing that to make my practice in line with, you know, what's respectful from your tradition? And she said, well, offer a gift to the plants. And I went, well, what? Like, I had a real hard time picturing what gift, like a CD, you know, a book? Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And she said anything, a little piece of cloth, some money, like a pen, some pennies, just any kind of small object, even, you know, if you have some grains of, I don't know, leftover bread or anything, just to put it on the ground near the plants. And so what often happens with me is I'm out gathering plants because it'll just happen, you know, I'll be somewhere and I'll see something and I'll go, oh, you know, I'll just wander out and pick some things. And then I'll go, oh, damn, I forgot the present. And that will remind me to have a moment of gratitude. Mm-hmm. So usually my moment of gratitude mm-hmm. is very much without an object, but it's the forgetting of the object that reminds me that, okay,
I have the moment of gratitude.
Yeah, to actually have a separate moment. Because when I'm picking, mm-hmm. I have a huge gratitude happening, but then to actually quietly just honor the abundance mm-hmm. of the world of green and, you know, a little bower
and plants
or something.
And what they offer. There's a wonderful book in our Nelson Library collection called Cedar. The name of the tree, mm-hmm. Cedar, is the title of the book by Hilary Stewart. And in that book, she focuses on the coastal peoples, the Coast Salish tribes, who were culturally related to the interior Salish, one of whose tribes was the Synext or is the Synext. Anyway, in Cedar with Hilary Stewart, she actually shows the translation of a song of gratitude that was sung by women of a certain Coast Salish tribe. When they were harvesting the cedar, they would pull on the bark from the bottom of the tree and pull it up, you know, taking strips off, and pull up until it came loose from the tree and then step back. And as they pulled and pulled on the bark, they would sing this song of gratitude, thanking the tree.
Oh, I like that.
And yeah, so I think even a song of gratitude might qualify for you. But that's an interesting book for people to have a look at, to see the depth and breadth of the cultural value of some of these plants, that it wasn't just about food and even just about medicine, mm-hmm. but in the case of a plant like the cedar or many other plants here, that there were other uses. Every plant had a use of some kind, and there was always a lot to be grateful for.
Thank you, Earth, for this good food. Thank you, Earth, for this good food, etc.
That's right. That's right. Even if all of us just practice a little bit of gratitude every day, I think that it's registered on many levels by the plant culture, by the natural culture that we live in. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to try to do that, whether you have some crumbs of bread or a penny or even, like I said, a song or even just a simple thank you. Mm-hmm. is a lot more than most huckleberry bushes ever get.
Mm-hmm. Well, and while we're on that issue of gratitude, I also like to include a moment of gratitude in my life here and now, you know, in different times and places, for the Synaics, mm-hmm. for the few remaining Synaics who are among us, who share their knowledge and their connection to this land. I honor them really deeply and try to find moments when they come up in my mind to just go, oh, thank goodness they are not extinct.
Right. And I will point out that the few remaining Synaics among us, that phrase that you use, is only because of a border and a very unfortunate set of practices by the Canadian government not to allow their entitlement to cross the border, because they are much a thriving tribe in the United States. And that's very often misunderstood or unknown by a lot of people here, that there are thousands of Synaics people south of the border. They tend to identify by their more more contemporary name of Lakes Indians. Mm-hmm. When you're on the Colville Reservation, you'll hear people say, I'm a Lakes mm-hmm. Indian, I'm of Lakes ancestry, mm-hmm. more often than you'll hear their traditional name of Sinaixt. But the border is an enormous opposition for them to feel entitled, because as soon as they cross the border, they become extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard for them to embrace extinction mm-hmm. when they have entitlement and identity south of the border. Mm. So it's a really tragic situation, but it's important for people to realize that there are many thousands of these people, and it's not as if there are just a few of them left on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
There are just a very few of them who are trying to hold a space in consciousness for us, mm-hmm. right?
And whom we have contact with.
That's exactly right.
That's a good reminder.
Yeah.
That they are.
You know, that they're not just this shriveled, destroyed group of people. But
I don't think of Marilyn or
Bob Campbell or any of their family in any way like that.
But
they have a steep uphill. They're a very small group who are here, who are trying to reverse the extinction practices mm-hmm. or the extinction proclamation. And it'll be a long uphill for them, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many thousands of Lakes Indians with that proud ancestry living today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Eileen, would you like to tell us a little bit about the museum project that you just participated in?
Yeah. The absolutely exhausting museum project. Take an introvert like me and throw her into a two-day program at a museum where she instructs and guides 300 children from around the area, from as far away as Fruitvale, up the valley at Slocan, all the way over to Crawford Bay. Children came from a long distance, elementary school children, primarily grade 5, and about 300 of them went through the museum program that was called Writing on Water. It focused on water culture, the canoe, the kokanee fish, and a time spent in the permanent museum exhibit at the Nelson Museum, which I'll give a strong plug for right now. Anyone who's out there in the listening audience who has not been through the permanent exhibit, you need to put that on your list of cultural activities for this year to look at the small but very compact and enriched collection of materials about Sinaixt and Yakanuki culture, the Yakanuki being a tribe of the Tanaha Nation who are centered at Creston. And they're a very culturally distinct group from the Sinaixt. They have an entirely different language and many different cultural practices, but they both shared this area for resource gathering. Anyway, it was an exhausting process for me. And the first question I asked the children was, where would you buy your food if it wasn't at the Save-On? Where would you get anything to eat? How would you survive if there was no Save-On, no convenience store, no Kootenai Co-op, no garden even? You know, what kind of food would you get and how would you get it? Interestingly, the large bulk of children, one of the first words that passed their lips was berries. They really understood that wild berries could help you survive, which I thought was nice that there was a little vestige of that information surviving. But they had less knowledge of some of the other, especially the root plants, the bulbs and things like that. But it was a wonderful initiative on the Nelson Museum's part, I would say in large part motivated by Catherine Fisher here, the host of our radio program, and her work with the Sinaixt. And Catherine really kind of, together with Marilyn James, birthed and nurtured the idea, and the Nelson Museum came along to support it in a very fundamental way. And every kid left with a little cardboard sturgeon nose canoe. And,
yeah, that was pretty cute.
Yeah, and I think they had their faces when they walked out of the building. A few of my friends were walking by, and they referred to them as having shining faces. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a lovely way to describe the impact that knowing about land and its culture can have. Children have an intuitive understanding, a rightness, that mm-hmm. this is something worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that connection, I think, in mm-hmm. a way that a lot of us don't feel the same way. But hats off to the museum, Columbia Basin Trust, and a few other of the sponsors, Arts Now, for sponsoring this program for the children. It was worthwhile, don't you think, Catherine?
I think it was great, yeah.
Yeah. So
that's wonderful. Well, what a lot of interesting information you guys are full of.
It's more than information.
It's more than information.
Deep
for sure.
Wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.